In a courtroom, there are lots of things other than the facts of the case that can influence the verdict. How much easier would it be for judges and jurors to reach a decision if they knew what the defendant, witnesses, and prosecution were really thinking? Believe it or not, devices designed to peer into people's brains to see how they're thinking and even what they're thinking already exist. A two-part program called Brains on Trial with Alan Alda explores how advancements in neuroscience could change the way we practice law and affect how criminal trials might be conducted in the future. And here to talk about those advancements are Alan Alda. Welcome back to our show.
Thank you.
And neuroscientist and psychologist Dr. Bea Luna. Hi, Dr. Luna.
Hello, how are you?
Hello, hello, Bea. How are you?
So good. Nice to hear your voice.
When will the shows be broadcast?
Next Wednesday night is the first show, and then the following Wednesday night, the 11th and the 18th of September at 10 o'clock on PBS.
When, during your distinguished career as an actor, director, and writer, did you develop this deep interest in the sciences?
I think I always had it, and it really got intensified when I had the chance to host Scientific American Frontiers. That began, I don't know, maybe 20 years ago.
Has neuroscience been one of the more intriguing interests?
You know, it all interests me. I even the visit we made to a lab that I didn't think I'd be interested in, where they made cookies that helped dogs have better breath, even that interested me. But the brain is, of course, probably the great last frontier that we're aware of.
And we still don't know as much.
I mean, it's
the
thing closest to our behavior, and we don't understand it.
Brains on Trial uses the hypothetical case of a teenager who robbed a convenience store and shot the clerk's wife in the process as a way of exploring the possible uses of neuroscience in the judicial system. Why use a fake trial?
We organized the trial to give us the chance to spring off of the moments in the trial into research that seemed interesting and relevant. So it's a trial. We were helped in forming the trial, in designing the crime and the way the trial went by experts in the judiciary, so that it would be convincing and also conform to what you would tend to see. And what's interesting about it is the first thought was to do the trial as a scripted event with actors acting parts. And because I've had so much experience with improvisation, I suggested that we improvise the trial with a real judge and real lawyers, but ordinary people improvising the witnesses and so on. And it's hard to look at that without thinking you're looking at a real trial, because they were totally immersed in it. And what we do is we'll zoom in on somebody's head while they're being a witness or something, and we'll find out what research has led to our deeper understanding of that part of the trial.
Dr. Luna, how did you get involved in this project?
Well, Graham Ted, the producer, reached out to me because of the work that I've done on understanding the adolescent brain and the ability that this work has had to inform some Supreme Court briefs that have to do with juvenile law.
Some scientists are uncomfortable being involved in things that popularize science. That's not a problem for you? I mean,
no,
you were collaborating with Alan Alda.
Right, exactly. Well, I don't know how that was a big pull. But, no, as a matter of fact, I've had many discussions with colleagues, many of who feel that way. I've grown to believe that I have a responsibility to do the extra effort to be able to describe the work that's done in a responsible manner, because someone will be speaking about our work, and it should really be done in a very responsible way.
And we make a special effort to be as true as possible to the work being done by the scientists.
And also offer a lot of objections along the way, which we'll get to. But how reliable is this neurological evidence? Can we actually see if someone is really telling the truth or lying?
Well, there are companies, at least last year there were two companies that offered for money to tell you if you were lying or not. And
offered to tell me if I – wouldn't I know if I were lying?
Well, I guess you could – they were offered to give you evidence that you might present to someone to prove you were telling the truth. Bay, you can join in on this. My impression is that most scientists feel – that there's some validity to it, but it's not ready for the court yet. It's not reliable enough. Well, is that how you feel, Bay?
Part of the problem is that polygraph tests have been considered unreliable and not acceptable in courtrooms. So would these be more reliable, Bea?
No, not necessarily. There are a couple of important factors. One is that even if it's 95% correct, that 5% has very important implications. Right, so the false positives would have humongous ethical implications. And even though functional magnetic resonance imaging, which is what we're talking about, has grown tremendously, it is not quite reliable at the individual level.
Well, you can defeat the test with certain techniques that are at least as easy as the way you can defeat a polygraph, and I think it might even be easier to defeat the brain scan.
If somebody's asking you a question, you could just simply think, elephant, elephant, elephant.
You don't even have to think. I think you can just move one of your fingers and it throws things off.
Well, even if it were possible to be totally accurate, you couldn't just wire everybody up in a trial and watch what they're thinking.
No, you couldn't. But one of the dangers is that a defense attorney might be very much motivated to bring lie detection evidence in and say, we did this on this $20 million machine and it's modern science, so of course you're going to believe it. And the jury is liable to put more trust in it.
Has neurological data ever been used in a courtroom trial?
In a courtroom trial, Bay, are you aware of that?
I think it has been used in several occasions. So, for example, you know, someone whose personality changed dramatically and then did something extremely severe, and then you find out that they had a gigantic tumor growing in the frontal lobe. Things of that nature have been presented. I'm not aware of all the cases, but I know that I've often been asked to be an expert witness, of which I only accepted once, and that was for very special circumstances.
What were the circumstances?
That's good. Yeah.
Well, I'm typically asked to be an expert witness when some horrible crime has been committed by a juvenile, and I find that very difficult for me to inform. Because, in fact, the juvenile did commit the crime, so I can't really inform culpability. The time I said yes was a minor who had done what minors typically do. They were very curious. They ended up in top of the ceiling of their school. They fell down. They were very injured. And that's all fine, but what the school was arguing is that what he did was not typical for a 12-year-old. And I felt that I could inform that. The 12-year-olds, I could inform the fact that they are risk-taking, that it is not atypical for a 12-year-old child, adolescent, to be exploratory and sensation-seeking.
One of the things that we deal with on the show is the two phases of the trial. The first week's show on Wednesday night will be determining guilt. The second week will be sentencing, and the brain studies have different things to offer in both of those cases. One of the big dangers that all the judicial people cite is that you don't want to give someone the defense that their brain made them do it.
But you also argue that if the neuroscience is completely accurate, it is at odds with the Fifth Amendment.
Well, that could be a question as things get better in brain science, as it gets more feasible to determine what. Let's say right now you can recognize the pattern when someone has been in a place before or has seen a face before. There's a pattern that's given off in brain activity that. But if that gets really accurate and you say to them, we're just going to put you in the scanner and find out if you were at the crime scene or not, even though you claim you weren't, is that forcing the person to give testimony against himself or herself? It's a serious question.
My guests are Alan Alda and Dr. Bea Luna. We're talking about a two-part program that will be on PBS called Brains on Trial with Alan Alda. Professor Nancy Kanwisher of MIT said that she believes functional magnetic resonance imaging, MRI, fMRI, scanning, can't be used in a real case anyway. What were her arguments?
It can't be used in a real case?
Well, she said
you can't drag them into the courtroom. You can't put the machine in the courtroom at the moment.
Was that her problem, or was that just not all that accurate? I mean, you participate in a lot of different neurological experiments in this series. What about the fMRI tests? Did you find them generally to be accurate?
Well, I can only tell you what scientists have told me about it. And as Bea just said, the accuracy of 95% sounds pretty high, but that other 5% is very troubling if someone's life is at stake.
But would that still be better than what we have right now? I think that the risk is a lot higher when we find out so many people are convicted of crimes that they haven't committed.
That's true, but I think the answer to that gets back to what we always hear when we complain about jury trials. It's the worst possible system, except it's better than anything we have. We rely on the judgment of the juries, and this is only supposed to amplify their ability to come to a decision.
And we have no idea about how unbiased the jury is.
There have been
many cases where people where appeals have been based on the fact that there may have been racial bias or other kind of bias.
Yeah, and we covered that on the show. There are studies that show implicit bias that the people are not aware of themselves. Somebody who might be an advocate for racial equality could show implicit bias.
At the University of California, Berkeley, you met with Jack Gallant, is that his name? He's trying to do something really amazing with decoding images from the brain that could be applied to racial bias.
I don't remember his exact experiment with regard to that, but I thought you were going to mention the I'm not sure if he did this or not, but maybe Bea knows. This amazing experiment where under the right conditions, and everything has to be just right, you can be thinking of a picture while you're in the functional MRI machine, and the computer will print out a fuzzy picture of what you're thinking of.
Wow.
that was pretty amazing. I think the racial bias one was one where they were able to assess that you were reacting differently to a member that is not associated with your racial group.
Yes, yeah. But I can't remember if that was Jack Gallant or not.
Yeah, well, I can't remember that either. Yeah.
The first experiment you participated in, Alan, was essentially a polygraph test based on an fMRI scan. How did it work and what were the results?
I was asked to take either a watch or a ring from a drawer. The scientists didn't know which one I took. And then I was supposed to lie about which one I took. And in the test we did, he correctly identified what the lie.
Bea, how was the fMRI scan able to show that Alan was lying?
Well, what you can do, and I think what they implement, and it's something that we use as well, is that with fMRI, you can identify patterns of brain activity throughout the brain. And there are a million different patterns. And certain patterns are associated with certain sensory experiences or even emotional experiences. And there are algorithms and computer models that can be used and train a computer to be able to identify and differentiate between different patterns of brain activity and the experiences associated with it.
Don't certain parts of the brain work harder when you're lying?
Some are. Yes, some do. I don't believe there's a real lying part of the brain, but there are combinations of exerting executive control and emotional aspects that form a pattern that would be more amenable to what's involved in lying. But as Alan mentioned before, you know, you could be tapping your fingers and engaging motor cortex and undermine that whole ability to perceive that pattern. So you really need volunteers that are willing to participate in an honest way.
But even on another level, don't psychological differences play a part in the accuracy of polygraph tests? A sociopath might very well pass without having to twitch a finger or do anything like that. Yeah. Would that apply with an fMRI as well?
Yes, conceivably so.
And one of the problems with all these tests is that a lot of the studies, I think I would, you can correct me, I have a feeling most of the studies are done by averaging the results of hundreds or dozens of subjects. So you can't say if Leonard Lopate's brain lights up in this particular area that it is associated with certain thinking or recognition.
I know when my brain lights up, but I'm not going to talk about it on the air.
but you might not match the average, you know? I'm sorry, what were you going to say, Ben?
And I think what Alan is pointing out is what I personally believe is the most important aspect of how neuroscience can inform the law. That, for example, in my area, which has to do with the adolescent brain, we're able to inform the justice system because we're looking at large groups of individuals and speaking about a large collective group, about the adolescent period. We're not talking about one individual person.
We don't have
that's
much.
When it can,
go ahead.
And that's when it can be of use.
We have very little time left, but in the second part of the series, you deal with how certain aspects of the younger brain are very different from a mature brain. Bea, can you explain how that changes?
Well, the findings that that have been accumulating and replicated are that there are two major things that are occurring during the during adolescence. You are starting to get the brain regions that support executive control, decision-making, and planning are starting to come online in the midst of the areas of the brain that have to do with motivation and emotion being overreactive, so that your decisions, which you are now able to make, are really very much being driven by motivational situations.
Now, we have no time left, but do you think that we'll ever see a situation where neuroscience will be applied to the courtroom?
I think everybody is saying it will happen.
Uh-huh. Well, it has informed three Supreme Court briefs. It wasn't the decisive point, but it was an important aspect. And Justice Kennedy, for example, has commented on it. And, you know, how the brain imaging data, you know, provides evidence for what we've always known, that adolescents can be kind of impulsive.
So sentencing has been limited for youngsters, people under the age of 18, and brain science was cited in the brief to back that up.
The two-part series, Brains on Trial with Alan Alda, will be broadcast on PBS on September 11th and on the 18th at 10 p.m. My great thanks to Alan Alda and to Dr. Bea Luna for talking with us today on our show.
Thank you, and thanks to the Sloan Foundation.
Yeah, thank you.